Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Say the name Frankenstein, and what immediately comes to mind is a grunting, lumbering creature, flat-headed, neck-bolted, as was first portrayed in the 1931 movie. But fans of the original novel will tell you that picture couldn't be further from the original. 2018 marks the bicentennial of the publication of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, or The Modern Prometheus, and Southwest Florida is marking the anniversary with a celebration to honor the enduring relevance of the novel 200 years later. Frankenfest is a series of events at New College in Florida and Sarasota that, in part, aim to give some insight into the many misconceptions people have about Dr. Frankenstein's so-called monster. We're joined now by the driving force behind Frankenfest, New College of Florida English professor Miriam Wallace. Hi, Miriam. Thanks for talking with us.
Hello. Good to talk to you.
We are talking about New College's upcoming Frankenfest with its ringleader, Professor Miriam Wallace. You can join the conversation, too, by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Miriam, when I say the name Frankenstein, what picture comes to mind for you?
Well, because I'm an English professor, of course, I've read the original novel, both the original first 1818 edition that Mary Shelley started writing when she was 18 and published when she was 20, and also the later, more common 1831 edition, which has been expanded and toned down. And so what I think of immediately is a creature who is made in some mysterious process that seems to involve charnel houses and and possibly body parts, but possibly also building some from scratch, who is superhuman, super fast, a vegetarian, can survive cold temperatures, but who doesn't know where he comes from and doesn't have a family and starts and discovers that he was created in this process and that he's all alone in the world. So a really sympathetic creature, actually.
So you kind of feel bad for him. You kind of like him. When did you first become interested in Frankenstein?
Well, the first time I read the book, I had read Dracula, and I really enjoyed that, and I'd seen all the movies, and I thought, oh, well, this will be the same kind of thing. And it just shocked me, because it's really a novel that is asking many, many questions. It's a philosophical novel. It's asking questions about family structure. It's asking questions about our duty to, if we bring something alive into the world, what is our duty to it? What is our duty to other human beings? It was so different from what I expected that I got kind of fascinated with it. And I've also found that it teaches really well because it shocks people out of their comfort zone. It gets science students talking to English literature students. It just gets people talking across all different sort of divides.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting aspect of it. But, people all have the one view of Frankenstein, and that's generally based on adaptations in various forms of media ever since the novel, but not the novel itself.
Right, and I actually think that's really interesting, too, that this novel, which in some ways is very much a product of its time and a product of kind of a hotbed of romanticism and an 18-year-old trying to prove herself to, Percy Bysshe Shelley and Byron. I mean, I can't imagine trying to compete with them in a story competition at the age of 18. But, then we get the movies, which is picked up on a different angle, which really ask questions about the mad scientist, which do sort of present the creature as both murderous, but also someone we often feel kind of sorry for. And then we've gone even further with it. We've got, we're taking John Cage's directions for creating a performance, a multimedia performance out of any text, and we're using Frankenstein. In the past, people have used James Joyce, which seems more obvious, but I think it's really interesting that you can do so many more things with it. And I don't know if you know, but there have been many, many novels and later versions of it. So there's everything from Alistair Gray's novel Poor Things, which has a female monster in which a pregnant woman baby's brain is planted in her body when she drowns herself, to there's a comic book by Victor Laval. There's a brand new book that's just out and available now on Amazon called Frankenstein in Baghdad. That's a translation of a book that won a lot of awards in the Arab-speaking world. So it seems to be endlessly generative.
Yeah, it's funny because I studied more the Dracula angle, and I never really studied the Frankenstein angle. So as far as, you know, what I was interested as a 20-something. Mm-hmm. So and what I find is really interesting is the gender situation, because here we have Mary Shelley mm-hmm. and her male contemporaries, and she becomes the breakout kind of in that as far as a blockbuster. And then as that is adapted into film, the people that were creating those films it was a more masculine based industry at the time. So that may have contributed to how it was reinterpreted.
Well, that's an interesting question. So, you know, so the thing to remember is that in the day, Shelley and Byron was sort of our first international rock star. I mean, he was, you know, he was the sort of sex symbol for the whole Romantic era. And he was also, of course, very complicated. The sexual relations among that crowd are very complicated. And it's really interesting if you think about that 1931 film that gets picked up later in Gods and Monsters is, you know, that there were a lot of gay men in Hollywood who were actually kind of entranced with the story and picking it up in interesting ways, too. But the story itself has almost no women in it. And if it's a story about taking over the power of birthing and you erase all the women, that kind of raises some really interesting questions, too.
Wow. So how did this book relate how was this book in relation to the other books that were coming out at the same time?
Well, it became quite popular, and actually there was a theatrical version that was put on in 1823, so it became popular enough that it went to the stage it came out in 1818, you know, not that many years afterwards, they're actually trying to put this thing on the stage under the title Presumption or The Fate of Frankenstein, which almost sounds like it could be a 1950s, you know, horror film, actually.
Yeah. And then when you had these books all kind of, not all, I mean, they seem like Dracula, Nosferatu was adapted, mm-hmm. and then you had the 1931 release of the Frankenstein movie not long after the book, and then this gave us the lasting image of Frankenstein as that bolt-necked creature. Do you think if they had made these films in today's day and age, if they would have presented him differently?
Right. Well, you know, Kenneth Branagh tried, and I didn't think it really worked all that well, which is kind of interesting. But, you know, I'm kind of curious about the turn of the graphic novel and the comic, which the one that I've seen some pieces of is called Destroyer, and what it does actually is it links the Frankenstein story with the Black Lives Matter movement, so that you get a descendant of Victor Frankenstein who's an African-American woman whose son is shot by the police, and she brings him back, because that's the initial impetus. Victor initially was sort of saddened by all the deaths in his family, including his mother, and he wants to know how to bring them back. So he starts by creating what turns out to be a really monstrous creature. But I think it's interesting that we're still sort of interested in, you know, what happens with grief? What happens when you lose someone? What if you brought them back? Would it be a good thing or would it be a bad thing? Would they be a force for good or would they take a monstrous turn?
Yeah, that's always kind of been a theme in a lot of different genre. So it's just like everybody always kind of hopes to bring somebody back, you know, but then is it a good idea or not?
Right.
we're talking about
what would that really look like?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. We're talking about New College's upcoming Frankenfest with the driving force behind it, Professor Miriam Wallace. And you can join our conversation by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So we're talking about the monster who was maybe not so much of a monster, but definitely not a human.
Well, he does commit murder, although he murders humans, and that's sort of a question, too. If he's not human, are they murders or are they something else?
Yeah, well, yeah. How is guilt assigned? And then we have artificial intelligence that we're talking about in this day and age, right?
Right, right, which raises some very... This actually links in with that in really interesting ways. At what point... And you can think back to even films like Do Androids... Well, it's Blade Runner, which comes from Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep. You know, if something can feel emotion and can respond emotionally and feels a desire for kinship, does that mean it belongs to our group? Does it then become human in some way?
Well, these are heavy questions for 1:45 in the afternoon on a Wednesday. Well, let's talk about Dr. Frankenstein, the doctor that puts him together. Sure. What was he really like? I mean, is he really the mad scientist as we remember him from the movies?
Well, you know, I in some ways, I think the concept of the mad scientist kind of begins with this book. I'm not sure I can point to an earlier version. So, you know, one thing to sort of know is that science was kind of hot in the late 1700s, early 1800s. You can actually still see King George III's scientific instruments in the British Museum of Science in London. So people did experiments at home, including the famous one we think of with Benjamin Franklin, that pulling lightning down from the sky with a kite. It turns up in Frankenstein. Victor and his family go out to the mountains, and they pull down lightning from a cloud with a kite. So, and Mary Shelley grew up in a family where they knew some of the leading scientists of the day who were also philosophers and also political reformers. So she's spending time with Joseph Priestley, who's the guy who apparently discovered oxygen, is considered the father of chemistry, and who's also a cleric. So this was sort of imbued in it. And so the interesting thing is that in the book, Victor becomes, he's like a student who goes off to college and becomes absolutely obsessed with one track of knowledge, and is outstripping his professors and spending all night long studying, and develops this project. So it's kind of a good warning for getting a little too obsessed with, you know, one line of thought. And I think that's really where the mad scientist comes from. It's this concern about the way we get obsessed with things, and then we can't see the larger picture, the larger consequences, or the intersections with other fields of study or with other people. So it's a little bit of a warning.
Well, it kind of highlights some of the philosophies of New College anyway, with you know, crossing different paths of study so that you have an understanding of a more round structure.
Right. So if you're, you know, if you're going to, you know, if you want to pursue a particular path in, say, artificial intelligence, at what point do you start asking ethical questions about what, you know, what does this mean in terms of, you know, what does this do to human relationships? Do you really want a car that can drive itself? Would that be good? Would that be safer? Would it save lives? That might be a good consideration. But you start to see that if you look across what we think of as disciplinary lines, which are really 19th century inventions anyway, you start to see implications that you might not see if you stay on a more narrow, directed track.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit like, do you take something as an engineering challenge? Does it matter if it's essentially a bomb trigger that you're developing? Does that, do you need to ask the question, is this the kind of thing I want to be a part of making?
Yeah, yeah. And what's this going to be end up being used for? And how is that going to impact humanity at large? And then the other character we got, Igor, the doctor's right-hand man, is he as common in the adaptations that we see as the creature itself? Is there any reason he's portrayed to be almost kind of like the creature?
That's a really interesting question. So he doesn't turn up in the original source material at all. One of the signs that Victor is going down a bad path is that he cuts off connection with all of his friends. He doesn't respond to letters. He doesn't respond to his fiance. He doesn't respond to his best friend. But the sort of help, the fact that he turns up in that first film and then he gets replicated in every other film version I've seen, including when you change studios. And I think you're right. There is a kind of doppelganger doubling thing going on there. But it's interesting that he's always portrayed as in some way physically anomalous, physically disabled. So that kind of makes me wonder about how we think about the creature as, in the original source material, super able to the point that he's really odd. Or in some ways, you know, is there a sort of anxiety about bodies that are different that is running through this that needs the echo of a second figure to really make it, you know, visible to us.
I think it's interesting. There's so much depth in something like Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit more about Mary Shelley. I always find it so interesting that she, as a woman, published this novel in the 19th century. Why did she end up writing this? You touched on it a little bit, that she was kind of competing with contemporaries.
Yeah, so the famous story about this, and it may not be true, it may be a fiction, is that she and Percy Bysshe Shelley and her half-sister, I'm trying to remember, I think it was Claire Claremont, she changes her name at one point, who was having an affair with Byron and pregnant at the time. So they were all sitting around, and I think Byron's friend Polidori was there, and they had just finished reading a French translation of German Gothic tales. And Byron said, well, why don't we all write a ghost story? And Percy had always been pushing Mary because both of her parents were famous authors. We've sort of forgotten them now. But her father was both an author of political tracts and an author of novels. And eventually he wound up running one of the first children's libraries under a pseudonym because the government at that time was sort of out to get him. So he was hiding under a pseudonym. And her mother, who died 11 days after she was born, was a very, very famous woman author and intellectual, Mary Wollstonecraft. So she comes from this hotbed of sort of intelligentsia and literary stuff, and then she's, you know, she's living with a married poet. His wife is at this point still alive back in, I think she's still in England. You know, and so she produces this story, probably comes out of the scientific experiments. They used to do these things where they would put an animal like a mouse, or there's a very famous painting that is a cockatiel in a big glass bell jar, and then they would suck the air out, and the animal would collapse and apparently die, and then they would let the air back in, and it would come back to life. So there's a Joseph Red of Derby painting that actually shows this experiment. So she must have gotten the idea from some of those experiments, but it's the way she puts it together and the psychological depth of the characters is really quite remarkable.
It really is. Are there any other works by her that we would recognize?
Probably not. She wrote several other novels, and I have to confess I haven't gotten around to reading them yet. One is about the end of the world. There's The Last Man. There's Valperga. Those are the two that I know you can get in print.
Yeah. So the event kicked off last month with the original 1931 Universal Studios Frankenstein. Then what other films are you going to be screening as this festival goes on?
So Ringling School of Art and Design is screening the films in their auditorium, which is wonderful, with short introductions by some of their faculty who give you a little sort of insight into what to look for. We just did the 1950s Hammer film. The next one that's coming up is going to be Young Frankenstein. So Mel Brooks' parody homage to the 1931. He uses the same electrical equipment, and that's on February 22nd at 7 p.m. And then the final film will be Gods and Monsters, which picks up on March 29th, which picks up on the sort of story of James Whale, the director who made that 1931, and then the Bride of Frankenstein sequel.
So, and then tomorrow there's going to be the first lecture, which is called Frankenstein and Genesis, Birth and Faith. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so there's a series that I put together at New College under the auspices of the Mellon Foundation, which gave us a grant. And it's just a chance, really, for people from the community to come back and have that sort of seminar discussion experience, but without any papers due. The thing that I think we all miss from college is sitting around with other smart people talking about an interesting topic. So I've asked some colleagues to do some of these, and this spring they're all themed around Frankenstein. So this Thursday, my colleague in Religion and Judaic Studies, Susan Marks, is going to lead a discussion about Frankenstein and Genesis and birth and creation, and I think the golem might pop up. And then there's one more on the 15th, which is going to feature New College students, and I'm talking to students who've written interesting papers about Frankenstein to come talk about what they made of the book, actually.
And then is that the one entitled, Oh Mother, What Art There? Oh Mother, Where Art Thou?
No,
Frankenstein at 200? What's that?
Yeah, that's the campus conversation. So Oh Mother, where does that one go? I'm looking at my list here. Oh Mother, What Art Thou, O Mother, Where Art Thou, Frankenstein 200, is a colleague of mine, and actually Frankenfest was kind of, we cooked it up between us at a conference. So she's written a book called Monstrous Motherhood, and one of the big themes of the literature from the period we studied together, late 18th, early 19th century, is figures of the monstrous mother, the mother who just isn't motherly. But there's the flip side, which is the idealized, perfect mother who, for some reason, always seems to be dead. So she's going to talk a bit about how much you see that figure of the idealized mother and how it pops up in Frankenstein.
That's really interesting.
Yeah,
you're talking about
another question.
You're talking about Frankenstein noticing that he lacks a family, and so then the mother that he might have hoped he had might be the more idealized version.
Well, and Victor gets the idea that he wants to study alchemy and then later science in order to bring back to life someone because his mother dies and he's so torn by the death. So in some ways, the creature is born out of Victor's own loss. And Mary Shelley is sort of famously, you know, lost her mother at 11 days of age, never knew her, read all her books, knew all about her, and I have heard those could mean, I may be quite, this may be a little bit apocryphal, that she and Percy Bysshe Shelley carried on some of their courtship at her mother's grave. So dead mothers are really at the heart of this.
Wow. Well, that's really, again, deeper than I thought we'd get with Frankenstein. You know,
it's a very deep book. It's deeper than Dracula, although Dracula has its own wonderful qualities.
It does have some qualities, but now I've got to go back and reread Frankenstein. It's been a while.
See, and that's my goal. I'm just trying to get everybody to read it because everybody will be surprised. And it's not that long.
Yeah, it is fairly short. How long is it? It's
under 200 pages. Depends on the edition you get.
Yeah. Huh. So what else are you hoping for people to get out of this semester-long fest?
Well, you know, part of what I've really liked is seeing people talk to each other in all these different venues about all these different topics. And Frankenstein, in some ways, just kind of a springboard to get people talking to each other across, you know, community, town-gown lines, across sciences and philosophy and literature and religion. It just seems to be a great way to create conversation, which I think is part of how we make knowledge and how we build community. So,
with the little time we have left, I wanted to ask how people can go to these events, get tickets. Is it open to the public? How does that work?
Everything is free and open to the public. It's sponsored by the Mellon. That's one of their conditions anyway. If you go to the New College website and type in Frankenfest, you can pull up a list of everything. If there are tickets, there's a link from there. And the tickets are really just so we know how many people are coming. I think for Professor Frankenstein's lecture, O Mother, What Art Thou, there's some of a seating limit, but it's pretty big. And for the campus conversations, we're trying to keep them down to about 15 to 20 because after that, it's not a conversation anymore, and we don't think people need more lectures.
Yeah, we've got to keep it kind of small when you're going to get interaction there. Well, that is all the time we have for today's show, but I really want to thank my guest, New College of Florida English Professor Miriam Wallace. I wish I could go to your classes.
I wish you would come too. Thank you.
Thanks for talking with us today. And I want to thank also my earlier guest during our segment on fake news, FSW Journalism Professor Ron Feimster. I'd also go to his classes. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary and Rachel Iacovone. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1. WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida. I'm